Hey, this is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it's a real treat and an honor to have Michael Ferris Smith with me today, talking about his absolutely killer new book, Salvage This World. And welcome, Michael.
Thanks,
good to
Pat.
See you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate your support and the support of the store over the years. It's been nice.
Absolutely. I think I first became aware of you when the book Rivers came out.
Yeah.
And just fell in love with that book and have been following your career closely ever since.
Thank you.
Just a remarkable body of work you're building and a varied body of work. I like how you go in completely different directions each time.
Yeah. You know, I got asked this past weekend, actually, like, kind of, what are you most proud of? And that's a hard thing to answer. You know, I think I'm really most proud of the fact that I'm still here. I do think that 7 novels now, and I think you can have really different conversations about every one. And that's something I kind of, you know, I take a little pride in, you know, for whatever reason, that's the way it's worked out. So I'm pretty happy about it.
Right. Absolutely. And we'll kind of dip back into the past and talk about some of those books as well. But let's just, because there's so much to talk about with this new book, Salvage This World. You know, it's set in, you don't really specify when, you get the sense that it's in near future, you know, maybe a couple years ahead of us. And we're in permanent storm season.
Yeah. That's a good
point. Can you talk, maybe just talk a little bit about what inspired this particular book? Did you start off with an image? You hear authors often say there was a particular image that got me going. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much exactly how I work. And I could say that about every novel. I think what you see in the opening pages is the thing that just kind of sticks in my head that I can't get rid of, that I start chasing down. There was that in Salvage This World. I mean, I think I had the first sentence of this novel written actually for probably a couple of months. And it was just kind of sitting there. This image of this woman standing, staring at thunderclouds with a kid on her hip and the wind blowing and dust in her hair. Something just grabbed hold of me, of that image. So that was my just jumping off point, who she was and what she was doing and what kind of trouble they might be in. But the other part of this that made it different was, you mentioned Rivers, that was 10 years ago. And for those unfamiliar, you know, Rivers really kind of pushes the boundaries to the point where the Gulf Coast region has been completely abandoned by the government because the hurricanes have just become so prevalent, and there's no time and there's no resources left to rebuild, and the people who decide to stay there. I always felt like I would come at Rivers again, maybe not in form of like a sequel or whatever, but I thought I might hit it indirectly. And so when I kind of had the notion for Jesse and Jay standing there, and they start, you know, doing what they're doing, I kind of thought, well, this feels like, it has that kind of Rivers feel to it, but I didn't want to go that far off into it. I thought, well, what if this is 6 or 8 years before Rivers, before the abandonment of the entire region, to where people are already starting to leave and not come back. The storms are more frequent. These little communities are just beginning to just become more dilapidated. And quite honestly, it felt really real to me because I think you see that now, to be honest. I think across Louisiana and Mississippi and even other parts of like Arkansas, you go across, drive across there, especially in the lower regions where storms have been bad, where the economy has never really recovered, where things are don't really have any structure to hold on to. There are fewer and fewer people there, and it's just, it gets rougher and rougher. So it's kind of where those two things collided. The notion of Jesse and Jace and this woman's young woman standing there with a kid on her hip staring at the coming storm, and this idea that this feels like 6, 8, 10 years before Rivers, like we're walking toward that time where you really can't be there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you see her there, and it's just like she could have stepped out of, you know, Greek mythology or something, or, you know, a very classic kind of character, you know, and just the resilience and, you know, what a, you know, how tough, as we learn, that she has had to be. And another thing I was going to ask you, there was an insight that I thought was very interesting. And it was that in this kind of near future, the major urban centers are the ones that are almost the first to go. And it's the smaller little communities that kind of hang on a little bit and have a little bit more resources and structure. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't know how accurate that is or not. Truthfully, I do know there is a stubbornness to those type of people that I think really attributes to what you're talking about. There's this real lack of interest in doing anything different. And I think almost a defensiveness in the notion that this place is not good for you anymore. It's not safe for you. We can't do much more here. And it'd be better off for you and your family if you were to go somewhere else. And the reaction is, well, who are you to tell me what I'm supposed to do? You know, no matter how bad it's hurting those, you know, that person or those people, they can't quite get past, this is where I've always been, and this is where I'm always going to be, no matter what. And I think it's stubbornness, but I also think it's, you can attribute that to people who have never had the chance to go anywhere else. Never had a chance to be anywhere else for, you know, whatever reason, socioeconomic reason, like whatever. And so that's as hard and scary as it is to stay where you are, it's likely for those type of people scarier to imagine having to go somewhere that they are unfamiliar with, even if it's just one state over or two states. It's a different town with different people. And I can't look out of my door and see the things that I know that I can like hold on to and squeeze onto. It's probably a combination of those things, but I do think in the rural communities and some of these kind of more rundown areas, it's harder to get people to let go. You know, I think probably there have been many books written about that type of psychology, but it feels very real to me and very tangible.
Well, there's that repeated kind of echo in the book about home, you know, and the importance of home. And it's one of the words that that the toddler Jesse says kind of early on in the book.
I think that has a lot to do with me too. My notions of home have been all over the place throughout my adulthood. You know, I've moved around a lot, which involved also getting away from Mississippi and getting away from the country for a while and living abroad. And then even as a kid, South Mississippi was kind of my home, but my dad was a preacher. So we moved around a lot. You know, we were never in the same community very long. It was always just like a couple of years here, a couple of years there. So like, even now when people ask me where your home is, I just say like, or where are you from? I just say Mississippi because it's hard for me to really like name a particular town or place that I really feel like I spent enough time there to where it's home. You know, there was a town where I went to high school, which is probably the place that's alluded to the most and is in all of my biographies. But even then, as soon as that was over, I was gone from there. You never really came back, you know.
Didn't you live abroad for a while?
I did. Right after college, I left and lived in Switzerland and France for several years, you know, and that was a big deal for me to kind of step back and see things from a more distant perspective. So the notion of home for me has always been kind of shifting, I think, you know, and I think that does come out in my work. I don't think it's anything intentional, but when I kind of finish a something and I kind of look back on it, I'm like, you know, these characters are really looking again for that place to land, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to find it. And I think a lot of that probably has to do with my own emotional makeup when it comes to the notion of what home is.
Right. Now, before I forget, my friend and coworker here, Bill, who's also a big music fan, we were talking before we got started about your guitars there. He wanted to know about, you know, the Mississippi, the music, you know, the blues music that comes from there, and specifically the great label Fat Possum, and if you're familiar with them, and if you like some of that kind of stuff.
Oh, man, absolutely. You know, one of the cool things about being in Oxford is that I'm really close to the Delta now. You know, when I was you know, hanging around in South Mississippi, and I lived over in the northeast part of the state before. It was a haul to get to the Delta, but I've actually become friends with Cedric Burnside here over the last few months too. And that's just,
he's the drummer and, right.
Yeah. And the Burnside family, RL Burnside and those guys, but Cedric's, he was playing drums for them traveling around the world when he was like 15 years old. Cedric was.
I saw him and RL at, and was it Kenny Brown? Kenny, who's the guitar player? Kenny something?
Yeah, it's Kenny. I don't know his last name.
I think it's Brown. Maybe Kenny Brown. I saw him here in Phoenix at the Rhythm Room, and I feel so fortunate to have been able to see RL.
Yeah, that was great. It's legit, man. But the juke joints are dying, you know, a little bit. There's only a handful left, so.
Junior Kimbrough.
Yeah. Oh, man, Junior Kimbrough was a killer. And like the North Mississippi Hill Country Blues too, I really like. It's got more of a like a drive and a beat and a rhythm and a, you know, it's a little bit different. And that's what's cool about the blues too, which I don't know how many people really get, the different, you know, styles. And I like Cedric himself, like he can play, you know, the old school blues because he grew up around those guys and grew up with it in his family. But he's also like just won a Grammy because he's kind of got his own kind of modern style of it too. Wow. And you can't talk about Mississippi without talking about the music.
That's right.
It's hard, you know, and I think it's important that the blues scene stays alive here too, because it's so unique to who we are and what's come out of here.
Have you seen that? And I know we won't digress too long, but have you seen that biography of Robert Johnson that has finally been published?
No, I haven't. Somebody was talking to me about it. Yeah. Scott is a friend of mine. He's like a huge Mississippi Delta blues historian and all that. I think he was actually telling me about it.
Who's that?
Scott Beretta. He lives in Greenwood, Mississippi, and he's just like, if you want to know anything about the blues, he's like the guy.
Our mutual friend Ace Atkins, who's been a really close friend of mine for 25 years or so. He's a great resource for all things music related.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ace is buddies with Scott too, you know, I'm sure. It's all kind of intertwined. We never get too far away from each other here, you know, the books and the music and all that. It's cool. I did not know about that book, but that there's a very cool Netflix documentary on Robert Johnson. It's animated, actually. It's only about 45, 50 minutes, but it's kind of,
is that right?
It's kind of interesting, yeah.
There was an interesting graphic novel that came out a number of years ago. Maybe it has the same artwork.
Maybe so.
Really cool. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if I mentioned while we've been live, but Michael lives in Oxford, Mississippi. You know, obviously Faulkner country, steeped in all sorts of literary heritage. And there's, you know, we were talking before we got started about just how supportive everybody is there. You know, you got yourself, Chris Offit, William Boyle, Bill Boyle, Ace, and I'm sure a bunch of other people too.
Yeah, I'm afraid to start naming them because I'll leave somebody out and then I have to answer for it later. But, you know, I would say there's probably 15 to 20 like working writers here, between poets, novelists, and like, you know, nonfiction. Great community. What's that? Tom Franklin's here and his wife, Beth Ann Finley. Yeah.
Yep.
Our local tavern, City Grocery, great bar, great dive bar. And, you know, that's kind of where we all congregate and cross paths and this and that and other. But it's really cool. Oxford's college town, but it's also still a small town, even though lots of people have been moving here. So, you know, you get to, I think it's really unique. I know it's really unique. Because I've been other places and I've talked to writers who live in other places, but the ability to walk into a City Grocery on Tuesday evening and see two or three other writers just kind of passing through in the same evening, just in the, you know, kind of regular run of the mill week. It's a pretty cool thing, you know. It kind of normalizes what we do. And I've lived in a place before where I was like the only one and it feels a little isolating. It can feel a little, writing is kind of an isolating thing anyway. So to be able to live in a place where you can feel kind of normal about what you do through the other people who are there, plus also having a great bookstore too, like Square Books,
Square Books,
I think it really adds to the dynamic and to the motivation of it all as well.
That's great. And it's cool that everybody kind of supports each other. And, you know, I'm sure you probably turn up for each other's events. And
oh, yeah, that's the fun part, man, to show up and applaud the other person and, you know, buy drinks so that they'll buy drinks for you one day.
Right. Well, let's see. Let's get a little bit deeper into this book. I need to ask you about, you know, can you mention sort of the main players? You got Jessie and her young son. Is it Jace?
Jace.
And she's in that opening scene. She's finds herself on the run. Can you kind of do the basic setup, and then we'll dig a little bit deeper into it?
Yeah. Like I said, I had that opening passage of Jessie and Jace just written. It was just a sentence that came out of me one day where I was just maybe sitting at home and I wrote it down and I just left it. But I always kind of thought that's going to be something. So I came back and to it and I just started following them and they are on the run. And I tell you where this novel really shifted gears for me early on, which that doesn't always happen. But on about that end of chapter 2 or maybe chapter 3, those first few little short chapters where she's trying to get away from the people who kind of came after them. And she's trying to figure out what to do because Holt, Jace's father, she's been gone for 11 days. So again, that's why she's running. And she knows whoever's after her has probably done something with him. She's grabbed these keys that he always told her to grab if you have to take running because they're very important, even though she didn't really know what they were for. But she stops, and there she's staring at this gas station. She's staring at this payphone. She has no idea what to do. And I didn't really know what she was going to do either. And she just walks over to it and drops a quarter in. And when she, you know, picks up the phone and she hears an answer on the other end, she says the word daddy. Like, that really hit me hard because I wasn't expecting it. And the other reason is I have two daughters of my own.
Mm-hmm.
I've never written about father-daughter relationships before. And when she said that, it kind of scared the hell out of me, you know, because I knew she was estranged from him and I knew there was a tremendous story there. And it really did. It frightened me a little bit and made me really nervous about diving into that. And I almost backed away from it. But I've learned, and I learned this a long time ago, that when you're feeling a little uncomfortable, you probably need to be feeling uncomfortable about things for it to be great. I think because that means you're going somewhere you haven't gone before. And there's been several instances I can remember in The Fighter. There was also a back off moment when I was like, I don't know if I want to do this or not. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Desperation Road. And there were certainly a couple of those in Rivers where I'm like, this is getting out of hand, and I don't know this is a road I want to go down. But then, like, I realized I was out of my comfort zone and I was dealing with things emotionally that I hadn't probably dealt with before as a writer in terms of presenting a story. And that to me is like the sign, like, well, this is it then. That's what you need to be chasing after to see how it goes. David Bowie has this great comment about that, about as an artist, you know, when you're out in the ocean, you can barely touch, your toes are barely touching the sand as the waves. Well, when the waves kind of pick you up and carry you, and all of a sudden you can't touch anymore, that immediate like nervousness and discomfort and like wonder that you feel when you can't touch anymore and you're just kind of adrift. He goes, that's when you get there as an artist, you're just about in the right place. And that's always made a tremendous amount of sense to me. When Jesse picked up that phone and said, daddy, I was like, it immediately struck me like, okay, so this is what this is going to be about. And you just got to embrace it and go with it. And I think anybody who's had a teenage daughter would be scared of it for the same reasons. Those are the players with Holt involved too, who finally, you know, shows up. But I knew early on it was going to be a story about a father and a daughter, and that both excited and horrified me at the same time. But I'm really happy and proud of how it turned out.
It's amazing now that you mentioned, well, I've never heard that Bowie story, which is really something. That's great. But when she says that word, daddy, there's so much in that, you know, as we soon learn, because she never calls him daddy. She calls him Wade. Yeah. And you you get a sense of her vulnerability there.
Right.
And so we learned, folks, this isn't a spoiler. We learned this very early on. You know, Wade's wife, Rebecca, is that her name? I can't.
Yeah, Rebecca.
Dies in childbirth. And so, you know, you get the sense, A, of how much he loved her, Rebecca, and how, you know, he's forced to raise a daughter. And he doesn't know what that was, you know, and they're real tight when she's a little girl. But once, of course, she reaches her teenage years, she needs a mom, and the mom's just not there. And you can fill in the rest. It's just a beautifully, beautifully wrought relationship.
Thank you.
And
no, I think you hit it nail on the head too, because she says daddy, you know, and that was how I wrote it initially out of the gate, went, daddy. And I'm like, because in the rest of the novel, she does largely call him Wade,
but
Wade. He's on the other end of that phone. They haven't, this is not a spoiler either. They have not spoken in a couple of years. And when he picks up the phone and hears her say daddy, his reaction is not the anger that he's been carrying around about it all, and not his frustration with her that he's been caring about, but he immediately relents because he can hear that in her one, in that one word she says, because they did not leave on good terms. But when she says that, he knows, like, she's swallowing a lot of her pride to do this and to pick up the phone and call me this. And that was a really, I think, exciting and horrifying moment for me at the same time. But it was really interesting for me to dive into.
And so we learned that, you know, Wade, you know, when she left, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but he was drinking pretty bad. And then he was able, you know, he put it down. He put down the booze for a while anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. We shouldn't get into that too much, but what I do want to get into is Elser, this character Elser. Tell us who she is and where she comes from. Was she based on any real life models?
Well, no, but she's probably a mashup of a lot of
everybody,
other types of people, you know. In the novel, like Holt, you know, before he comes around and finds Jesse and they run off together, he's been engaged with this traveling gospel carnival called the Temple of Pain and Glory. And Elser is this wiry, hard little woman who's the preacher, I guess, for lack of a better word, who delivers the sermons with fire and brimstone. But she's also taking advantage of a very downtrodden people, and she's berating and their last dollars out of their pockets in the name of the Lord, because she's promising that, you know, if they stay in this region, if they just pray and believe and empty their pockets, then boy, there's going to be all kinds of salvation. And then they pack up and they leave and they go to the next town, do the same thing the next day. And, you know, she, you know, when I thought of Elser, I'm like, here's a woman who is very sure of herself. Here's a woman who's probably smoked about 5,000 cigarettes in her lifetime. And she has that hard, road-worn look, but she also has a way about her of manipulating people and, like, even intimidating people, you know, I think, too, even to be a such slight stature, just she's an intimidating figure. And I think the important thing for me was, as well as with the Temple of Pain and Glory, is to push her as far to the extreme I could, as but keeping her also in the realm of believability, not making her like a cartoon or a caricature, which I think is really key to a lot of great fiction, is that you drive your characters and you push your characters to extremes, but they live also in the realm of, I feel like I could reach out and touch them, you know.
Well, I think some of the very specific details do that, you know, such as the hearse that she drives. That was a great touch. How did that occur to you? Is that something that you've seen, or just seemed like?
I don't know, man. It just seemed like something she would drive, this big old 20-year-old hearse, you know.
Right.
That's kind of shifty looking, like something you see parked outside of a haunted house, you know, or on Halloween, you know, to scare you, with fog coming out of the back of it or dry ice coming out of the back of it. She's like in it and driving around it.
Right. But I mean, it seemed very contemporary in a kind of a sad way almost, you know, because it's like, as you say, she's preying on the people's desperation and their vulnerabilities. And, you know, unfortunately these days we're seeing a sort of some of that old con stuff coming full circle, and you're seeing more and more of that out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty timely thing, I think. And it's not an old con. I mean, it's not a new con either. It's an old con, but it works over and over and over and over, both on big scale, I think. Clearly it works on a big scale, and also on a small scale, like a traveling gospel carnival, you know, where they pop up a tent, they put out 50 folding chairs, the locals come, and then they pack up and go off and do it, you know, somewhere else. It's an old con, but it works over and over again. And I think it's using those, religion's been used thousands of times to rob people, you know.
Sure.
People who are using it for the wrong purposes wrap themselves up in it and promise this and promise that for the point of getting, you know, perpetuate this idea that I'm holy and I can give this to you and I can help you with this. But really, they're just reaching into your pockets the whole time. And for some reason, there is a population of people that cannot get past that. You know, they cannot trust themselves. Instead, they're willing to just be a part of it, you know. That's the psychology that books have been written about, and I can't really sit here and try to explain it. But it was fascinating to write about. I know that it felt like it was very fertile landscape, I think, both for the way Elser was doing her job and for the people who have been through a lot, you know. And like I said, down here in South Mississippi and Louisiana, South Louisiana, the people have been through a lot with these storms, even now. And those communities have, and they've lost a lot, and it's going to continue to go on. And just the willingness to be at a revival like that while the wind is blowing and it might even be rainy, and to just simply believe that this person here is giving me the truth when the truth is truly all around me, you know, my eyes and my ears do one thing, but they tell me something else, but I'm going to go this way.
Well, also, you know, there's this sense that when the rest of the country's abandoned us, you know, and then this person is putting forth a very powerful us and them message.
Yeah.
There's a key scene in the book where she does precisely that.
Yeah.
Them. You keep saying, you know, are you going to be with them, or are you going to? And you're right. It's a classic con.
Yeah.
And your reward will come in some afterlife.
That's right.
It's not here and now.
Yeah. It's not now. It'll be.
I'll enjoy the riches of everything now. Yeah. You guys are going to have to wait. Right. Yeah, it's a classic con.
Yeah.
And you see it with, you know, some of those, you know, the Branch Davidians, Jonestown.
Yeah.
And I thought a little bit of Amy Semple McPherson.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And it was interesting, I thought, that you made her made it a female.
Yeah, you know, too, that kind of goes back to I didn't want that character to be the same old thing,
right?
And I think that's important for storytelling. I mean, clearly this is nothing new either. I'm not telling anybody anything different here, but it's important for storytelling that, you know, because that she could have been that character could have been a caricature very easily, right? So how do I take this character that I believe I want in this novel and make it something we haven't quite seen, you know, just yet? How can this character be different? And I think making her a rough, hard little old woman, you know, with a cigarette hanging out of the side of her mouth, driving a big black hearse and basically pointing and telling people what to do and them nodding and doing it gave her a lot of dynamic and dimension, I think. And I think it made her unique. I hope it made her unique.
I'm just looking on Facebook and sorry, folks, I'm writing solo here, so I'll try to pay attention to the comments and everything. But Robin, a friend who watches a lot of our live streams, she wants to know, would you feel comfortable reading the first paragraph to us?
Yeah, let me find a book.
All right. There you go, Robin. By the way, folks, we are going to have signed copies of Salvage This World soon, and you know how to get them. So I'll try to put a link up on the comments field.
That's right. They are actually arriving on my doorstep any moment. They may have arrived already. I think I heard somebody out there, and I'll sign them and be shipping them out to you tomorrow.
Awesome.
Reed, how much? The first chapter?
Or no, you don't read the first chapter, maybe the first paragraph or whatever you need.
Oh, yeah, the first paragraph. That's cool, yeah. All right. She stood bathed in twilight, the dust in her hair and a kid on her hip, and she stared at the approaching storm as if trying to figure out how to wrangle the thunderheads and steer them to a distant and parched land where desperate souls would pay whatever ransom she demanded. The acres of sugarcane cut to nubs surrounding the house. A dry autumn turned into an unpredictable winter, and then 11 days ago, he left and she'd seen no one since. It was a mile walk along a dirt road that separated the acreage and another 8 miles to walk to the nearest telephone. But even if she wanted to bundle up and make it, she wouldn't know who to call. He was gone, and he had taken the car and the cigarettes and every dollar except for the stash she kept hidden beneath the floor plank in the closet. She had finished the last of the whiskey 3 nights ago. The milk had run out yesterday. Jesse stared at the storm, and the wind began to blow, and dust clouds rose like souls awakened, and she listened to the wind and welcomed the sound of something else.
That's great. There's a whole novel in that paragraph, isn't there?
It feels like it. You know, that's a great feeling as a writer to write down the first thing out of your head and realize there. I have really a lot to work with here. I feel there's a novel here, you know, in this paragraph. That's a great feeling.
Before we got going live, I asked Michael about this thing that appears in the book called The Bottom. And it's almost like this mythic place. I'm almost tempted to ask you to read another bit. There's a wonderful bit at the end where you talk about, and on my advanced reading copy, it's like page 214. Yep. It's the paragraph that starts, the bottom was out there. They were sure of this.
Same page. Yeah.
Would you mind reading that little bit?
Yeah, I like this part.
Yeah.
The bottom was out there. They were sure of this. And the tales they had heard about the mythical place had no limit. Maybe it was in Mississippi and maybe it was in Louisiana. It was somewhere that did not exist on a map. It was somewhere that was lost in time, a place to be reckoned with. It was a haunted and ghoulish settlement of old graves that had been pushed to the surface from 100 years of flooding, and the caskets lay broken and open as the dead walked in the night looking for a dry place to rest. It was the last retreat for Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, where the men grew so hungry and frail that a horde of alligators watched from surrounding marshes and then feasted on the feeble soldiers too weakened to escape. It was a fortress created by pirates, where cannons poked between thickets of twisted vines and booby traps capable of decapitation protected the mounds of treasure hidden in its rotted depths. It was an insane asylum where the tortured cries of the demented patients could be heard echoing through the midnight fog. It was a home for devil worshipers gathered to make sacrifice to their heathen god and drink the blood of the innocent. It was inhabited by sex cults where mobs of the naked and carnal sang to one another in the moaning and groaning of copulation. The bottom had many lives and many truths, depending on the generation and the kinfolk of the storyteller, but the one thing that all of the stories agreed upon was that the entrance to the bottom was marked by a thick stone wall and an ancient gate decorated with a cross that may or may not have been upside down. Nobody was sure how this was known about a place none of them had ever seen.
Love it.
Yeah, man. That's some good old riding around the back roads ghost story stuff right there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, was that something that, was that your invention or was that your kind of riff on a kind of thing that you grew up hearing about?
It was mostly my invention, but I think it certainly stemmed from stuff like that. You know, I grew up in small places, and I mean, our pastime in high school was loading up the cooler and go riding around all night long, back roads and down here and there, and like just out in the woods and this and that and the other, and find a little river and little riverbank. And, you know, so stories come out of that, and tales come out of that, and rumors come out of that over time, not just from us, but people before you. You hear things, and, right, you know, I think the South is full of ghost tales. I think most small places are. So it was probably some of that, but the bottom was all mine, you know, and maybe it's out there somewhere. I like to think it is.
Well, there's also this hint that the bottom is a place within inside us too, as well. Not a physical.
You know, it's great. That's interesting, Patrick, because I didn't really think of that much, but when my editor read this the first time, he called me and said the exact same thing. And I thought, well, that was,
is that Josh?
That works nicely. Yeah. Josh Kendall. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant guy.
Yeah. Great guy. But he had a very similar reaction to that.
Let's see here. Okay. And so before we kind of get on to some other things, I wanted to, you know, so one of the things, this, how the salvage comes into this, you know, I think it's the last line of the book that you kind of, and don't skip to the last line, folks, but there's that, you know, Wade, he's found a way to go on, you know, by rehabbing this abandoned old trailer that he finds and getting it, and he goes out and fills it with scrap and kind of cobbles together a living that way.
Yeah. You know, the title came early, and I really don't know where it came from other than I knew this was going to be a group of really desperate characters and a really desperate landscape, scratching and clawing for everything, emotionally, physically, spiritually. However it came across my mind, I loved it because it spoke to that desperation, but it also speaks to the hope of there is something there. There's something there, you know, if you can just find a way to salvage what's there, like to save, to go and gather, to bring it home, to take it with you, in whatever form. I just really love the title. And I also felt like it was the kind of title that had to be earned too. And I really love that feeling about a title or a notion for a book. Like, I feel like I've pushed myself out there with the beginning or with the title or whatever. Now you've got to go. You got to go earn it and make sure it lives up to it. And so there were a dozen things I felt that worked for that title, including the notion that I've got to really be ambitious and going to satisfy this, because I don't want to change it. You know, I don't want to get to the end of this book and think, well, maybe it's not there. Maybe it's something else. I really wanted to earn that title because it felt special to me in some way.
Well, there is also that sense of, you know, these characters going on the classic underworld journey,
yeah,
you know, going down and coming, yeah, you know, maybe coming back up, maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Let me see what else I got here. Yeah, let's just talk about, we'll stray from this book for just a second, but tell me a little bit about the portrait of the artist as a young man. You know, when you were growing up, did you have literary aspirations from a young age, or no?
No, man. I mean, there couldn't have been anything farther from my mind. You know, I grew up, like I said, my dad was a preacher, my mom was a school teacher, but I was a ball player growing up, and, you know, whatever was in season, it's what I was playing. It was really all that interested me. Like, my plan when I was a kid and a teenager and through high school was to be a major league shortstop, and, you know, that was it. And I played ball in a junior college for a couple years after high school, and I suddenly realized that ain't gonna happen. And I stopped playing ball when I was 21, and when all of a sudden that kind of regimented day was gone for me, and there was no more practice and no more coaches and no one to tell you where to be and see if you're going to class and stuff like that, it's the story of anybody who doesn't have any real interest and suddenly feels kind of lost. You're not going to do very well in whatever it is you do. And I went to Mississippi State, and it took me 4 years to graduate, but that was after going to 2 years of junior college. So, I mean, that should tell you something about the kind of student I was. I think I majored in communication. I graduated like a 2.5. I mean, I really didn't give a shit about much of anything. I just wanted to be out and be done, and hopefully something would hit me one day. And
but yeah, I was on the 7-year plan myself.
Yeah. There's something. At least we have a happy ending. That's all I gotta say. Right. It didn't seem like it at the time. By dumb luck, I stone tripped and fell in living abroad for several years. And when I was doing that, I started reading for entertainment for really the first time in my life because of the language gaps. And in Europe, in Switzerland, France, and wherever I was, I saw people reading on the trains. They were reading in the cafes. They were sitting in the park. Like, a lot of people had books with them. And I thought, okay. So whenever I could find an English language bookstore, I would go and I would get, like, if you went to high school, any name you would, the names you would know, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, because of Mississippi, I knew that name, Flannery O'Connor, Charles Dickens, like those writers. And I started, you know, reading. And the thing that happened, which life is funny, because I talked about home, right? Well, as soon as I got in Europe, particularly in France and particularly Paris, I felt some type of comfort there that I had not like felt before in terms of place. And I really fell in love with it. And even though I was in a foreign land, something felt strangely like normal. And I felt strangely comfortable there. So when I started reading Hemingway's stories, and I see his characters are sitting at the cafes in Paris, and I was sitting at the cafes in Paris, and his characters are going to the bullfights in Spain, and I was going to the bullfights in Spain. Like, I immediately felt some like type of connection or camaraderie to that in a way I did not expect. You know, I had to go to across the ocean to a different continent and pick up something to read there that actually made sense to me in the place I was, which was a very unexpected thing to happen. Well, I kept doing that. And I came home to visit one time, and I actually had friends in Oxford, and I came through Oxford, and I walked into Square Books, and on the front table there, they had a Mississippi writers table. And I really wasn't familiar with any of those like modern, like contemporary names. And but I saw a book of short stories, Big Bad Love by Larry Brown, and a novella, Ray, by Barry Hanna, both Oxford writers. And I picked them up and I read them both that night. I sat down on a porch at like midnight and just cracked open Big Bad Love and started reading. And I read the entire collection, and then Barry's novella is only about 120 pages. And I just sat there and I read for like several hours, and it really hit me. Like, I've been reading the greats, right? But that, you know, it still was time going by. When I read Larry Brown, I'm like, holy shit, I know these characters. I know these back roads. I know this landscape. And same thing with Barry, the voices in his characters and the places and the right now of Mississippi and these characters who were living and going through the things they did. Like, I was like, I understand this. Like, I feel this. I know this. And I took those books back to Europe with me, and I reread them over and over. And it was during the course of that something just started maybe, you know, moving in me. And I thought, you know, what if I wanted to try this? I mean, I wonder if I could do this. Because I started reading Larry's interviews, and he talked about just being a reader, and just when he was 29 years old, how he just decided he wanted to try. And I was approaching that age, you know. When I came back to live in Mississippi, I was like, right at the edge of 29. And when I read that about him, he'd just been some guy. He never had any real interest, but he just started reading and fell in love with it and wanted to try it himself. That kind of made me feel like I'm not crazy. It's possible.
Gave you permission to do it.
That's exactly how it felt. And so I came back home, and that's what I did. I decided I wanted to try to do this. And it's nothing you can really tell anybody because it sounds so weird, you know. And I didn't even really know what that meant. You know, I had no idea what that even meant. I'm going to go try and write. Like, what does that even mean when you have never done it before and you're an adult at almost 30 years old and you're like, okay, this is it. And, you know, while I've been gone for years, my friends and people I knew had gotten married, had kids, bought houses, you know, time had just kept going and life had kept moving on. And it kind of goes back to that notion of being kind of wanderer and wondering about home and like where you fit in and where you belong. And But I didn't have a plan B really. I just, all of a sudden I felt passionate about it, even though I can't say I quite really understood what I was getting into. I felt this something kind of pumping through my blood. The only thing I knew was if I'm going to try to do this, I knew enough about the literary history in Mississippi. I said, if I'm going to try to do this, I'm going to go back home to Mississippi, and that's where I'm going to do it. And so, yeah, it's a roundabout crazy story about how I came to it. Even talking about it, sometimes I think, man, I don't know how you ever came to this, but I'm glad you did, you know, because I fell in love with it, the process, and like the immediately. I had no idea how hard it was going to be. No idea. And I'm glad I didn't know, because I would have probably quit before if somebody said, you know what, that's great, you get started, maybe 10 years from now you'll have something. I'd have been like, yeah, I don't know. But that's kind of how it was. But
did
here
you have any mentors or teachers along the way that really helped you?
The one thing I knew was that if I'm going to do this, I can't just go back to my old hometown and sit and try to do this and work some odd job, because I had nobody to talk to about it. So what I did was the Center for Writers at the University of Southern Mississippi at the time, Frederick Barthelme, his brother Stephen Barthelme, and Mary Robeson was there at the time as the faculty. And I went over, and I begged them to let me in. Like, I didn't have any writing samples. I had a shitty GPA from undergrad. I just told them about who I was, where I'd been living, what I've been doing, and how I'd come to this. And just, if you would just give me a chance, I think I can do it. And I'll never like make you say, oh, we should have never let him in the program. And they did. They let me in. And Stephen Barthelme in particular was a tremendous influence on me, because he really, like, even at that stage, he saw like what my sentences were like and kind of where I was coming from. And he really pushed me in that direction. He didn't try to make me into another writer or somebody who wrote like him, you know, and he really challenged me. And he was also a great line by line editor. He wouldn't just talk about the story, but he would also tell me why one word, this word works better here than this word, and how important your word choices and your images are from, like, in a like a line by line moment. And the last thing he said to me before I left that program, I was 32 years old. I had actually somehow managed to publish a couple of stories in literary journals at that time, and I was scared to death to be leaving that program and not having that kind of community to depend on anymore. And I was sitting with him in his office, and I had been in his short story class that he was teaching, the reading class, and he had a stack of books on his desk. And I remember he looked at me, he goes, let me tell you what your problem is. He goes, you're just trying to be the best writer here at workshop. He goes, that doesn't mean shit. You know, who cares if you're the best writer here at workshop? You're supposed to try to be better than, and he started pointing at the books, and it was Hemingway, Faulkner, Gene Reese, Carson McCullers, Anton Chekhov, everybody we had read in that course. He goes, that's who you're supposed to try to be better than, not the people walking down the hall here. He goes, when you realize that, that's when you'll become like what you're supposed to be. And that spoke to the athlete in me and the competitive nature of this. And it like kind of hit me right between the eyes, clearly, because I still remember it. I mean, it's still one of the most important things anyone ever did for me as a writer.
Now, was Rivers your first published novel?
I had a novella before that called The Hands of Strangers. It was published by a little tiny press in North Carolina. And then Rivers was the first novel.
Is that novella still in print?
Yeah, Blair Publishing.
I'll have to pick up a copy of it.
Reissued it a few years ago. And yeah, it's a great little, and it's set in Paris too. You know, it was a short story I had published that was set in Paris, but it was a short story I always felt like there was more to. And I sat down and just started a chapter two after that, and it ended up becoming my first publication.
Wow, I'll have to pick up a copy of that. Yeah. Well, let's talk just for a minute or two, and there may be some questions here, but I wanted to ask you about Nick, about how you came to write that novel.
That's another crazy story. And honestly, if it wouldn't have been for my own expatriate experience, I don't think it would have happened. It was after Rivers, actually. It was around 14 or 15. And I was just looking for something to read one day in my house. And I wanted something short, something I could just tear through. And Gatsby was sitting there. And I hadn't read it in like 15 years. And honest to God, I didn't remember anything about it. I had been forced to read it in college when I was like 20. I was like, I don't understand what the big deal is about this book. I read it again when I was probably, I think when I had been living abroad, and things in it then kind of started to make a little more sense to me. But then I just kind of brushed it off and put it away. I picked it up, started reading it, and like every page was just like singing. I was like, this is an incredible piece of work. And I get to the end of it, or close to the end, where Nick realizes it's his birthday. He's forgotten, he's turning 30. And that just smacked me. Like, how could you be so detached from yourself that you don't realize it's your birthday? Not just your birthday, but a really, you know, the decades are big birthdays. And then he goes on to say, just a few sentences later, that he anticipates his 30s to be a decade of loneliness. And that is the line right there that drove me to write Nick, because in that moment, I remember I put the book down, set it aside, because all I could think about was myself at 29 years old, coming back to the States, deciding I wanted to write, feeling really isolated from anything, anybody I had known, realizing this has a very good chance of going bad. And I was about to turn 30, and my friends have jobs and families, and this is what I'm doing. And it scared the hell out of me. And I knew exactly how he felt when he said that. And when that line came across in Gatsby. And I remember I got up and I walked around my house for a little while. And then I came back and picked it up and finished reading it. And I just kept thinking about it and thinking about it, like in the next few days. And I was talking to someone. And in the conversation, I said, it would be so interesting to me if somebody were to write Nick's story, because he tells you nothing about himself. Like, where does that feeling come from? And just as soon as I said it, I thought, well, you're a writer, and you love it. Why don't you do it? You know, you're the one who's so interested. Why don't you do it? And I mean, in a nutshell, that was a lightning bolt moment. And then I just kind of sat down and did it. And I didn't tell anybody what I was doing because I didn't want anybody to tell me I was batshit crazy, but that was probably a good idea.
Now, did it feel, of all of your books, did that feel a little bit like you were taking dictation?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. That is a book that I think I really got to dive into a part of myself that maybe I haven't quite with the others, just because of my own experience of being in another place and kind of coming back around to yourself, if you know what I mean. Like when I left to go to Europe at 24 and I came back at 29, it was like one person left and a different person came back. And I saw a lot of that in Nick, like where he was when he was 20 at Yale. He was a tremendously different person than he was when he's standing there in that moment. And he says, I'm looking at it, I'm staring at a decade of loneliness. The other thing that hit me right out of the gate with it was, it has to be like some PTSD issues, and that's got to be the war. You know, the right. First thing him and Gatsby say to each other is, well, where were you in the war? Or did you fight in the war? That's the first thing out of their mouth. And I thought, oh man, I'm about to get to go to Paris. I'm about to get to go to World War I. And then I got to come home. Right. So those were feelings I think that I hadn't really, they're feelings I've always had, but I think in terms of me taking that lap as a writer in a novel, that really felt like that experience of my 20s for me, perhaps maybe in the ways that the other ones haven't.
Right. Right. Was it a quick book to write for you compared to the others? Or not necessarily.
No, none of them have been that long. I think I wrote Nick and revised it before I gave it to my editor in like 10 or 11 months. I've never had one go for more than like a year and a half. But that first draft of Nick came pretty fast. And then I set it down for a minute. And then I kind of went back to it because I don't really like showing anything to anybody until I feel like you could walk into the printer and print it out and it'd be a pretty good book, you know. I'm not a fan of searching out opinions when I'm in the middle of something.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've also done some screenwriting, right? You've done a couple of adaptations of your own work. How's that been? Has that been enjoyable or?
Yeah, it's been cool, man. When I was approached about doing it, I wanted to do it. I didn't know how to do it, but I wanted to do it. When they asked me, I remember being on the conference call when the question came up, would you like to be attached to write the script? I said, yes. And the next question was, do you know how to do it? And I said, yeah. And when that call was over, I hung up and I called my manager immediately and I said, hey, man, I need to know what are two good books about screenwriting, how to write a screenplay. He just kind of laughed. He goes, I knew you didn't know how to do it, but I'm glad you said yes. It was something different, you know. It was a great opportunity to try to do something different. Whether I could do it or not, that was yet to be determined, but I felt like I wanted to try.
So you did. You adapted The Fighter, right?
Adapted The Fighter and there you go.
Yeah.
Desperation Road. The Fighter, yeah. It comes out at the end of the summer. The screen name is Rumble Through the Dark, which is the last line of the second chapter, actually. And then Desperation Road will be out next spring. We shot it last fall.
Wow.
It's such a different process because it's so much more collaborative. And the other thing, too, is I've heard all the horror stories about writers who sell their novels and then the movie becomes nothing like their novel. I didn't want to risk that. I wanted to try to keep my hands involved with it for as long as possible. You know, they could have booted me really at any moment. So I really knuckled down and tried to do a great job so that they couldn't, you know, get rid of me, you know. And I think because of that, and I had great relationships with the directors of both films, and they told me, we want the novel on the film. We want a faithful adaptation. So too, that really let off the kind of pressure and stress of it also. And that's a nod to them and a benefit to them that they gave me that freedom to do that. And when we did revise, because things do have to change, it was within the confines of the story that was there, you know. We weren't changing the story. We were probably just shifting some nuts and bolts around and a little of this and a little of that, but they're both really faithful adaptations. And I'm very relieved, first of all, but also very happy, you know, about that.
That is too cool. Any actors that we might know and with the
movie? Aaron Eckhart played Jack Boucher in The Fighter, and he is tremendous. I think when people see him, you know, like when people saw The Wrestler and Mickey Rourke, and it was like,
yeah. Great movie
for him and really surprised people. Eckhart is the same way in The Fight. I mean, what he put into Jack Boucher was tremendous. He came out to the Delta and we put him up. He lived in a cabin in the Delta for a couple of months so he could listen to people talking and get familiar with the landscape. And like, he went like full method, you know, adapted a certain walk and a certain accent and a certain way of moving with the pain, you know, that Jack deals with so much in The Fighter. Like he really, I can't wait for people to see what he did. Bella Thorne plays the tattoo carnival gal in The Fighter in Rumble. And she did a tremendous job. Big Mama Sweet was Marianne Jean Baptiste. And she is an Oscar award nominee and she was incredible. You know, Desperation Road, Garrett Hedlund plays the lead. Mel Gibson actually plays his father in it.
Really?
And Willa Fitzgerald, an actress I didn't know at the time, but she's great. She's been in some cool TV shows. She plays Maven in Desperation Road.
Great.
Fantastic job, you know, all of them.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
We'll wrap it up here, but a question has come in. Robin would like to know, with your mom being a teacher, did you grow up with books in your home? Was reading and imagination part of everyday life?
Yeah, there were books in our home, you know, but I tell you what, when I think about my imagination being stirred as a kid, it was from church and it was from Sunday school lessons and the stories from the Bible. I remember I had a Bible that was animated. So like when you got to Daniel in the Lion's Den, there would be an illustration of Daniel sitting in the lion's den and Moses standing there with his arms outstretched, parting the Red Sea. Those stories, Bible stories, are so there's a couple things. One, they're really short. You know, if you look up a story in the Bible, it's about yay long.
Right.
That's probably a big one, a long one. So they get right to the point. The images in them are tremendous. I mean, as a kid, imagining a burning bush that you're having a conversation with, what a fantastic image. You know, a crown of thorns, you know, a guy leading his people to the sea and raising his hands and God parting the sea, and the good guys run through, and when the bad guys run through, it collapses on them.
Jonah and the whale.
Yeah, Jonah and the whale, you know, just one after another. These stories are filled with the tremendous images, heart and soul, and they're also filled with things like failure, redemption, perseverance, courage, hope, loss. I mean, it's thematically speaking, I kind of feel like I'm talking about my own work sometimes, but like those were the stories that really stirred my imagination. And those were the first stories I knew, you know? So I think when I started reading as an adult, that part of me was rekindled, that would sit in the pew or sit in Sunday school class and just be kind of mesmerized by those tales. You know, Noah and the Ark. I mean, my God, that's a tremendous story, you know? Whether you believe it or not, it's a tremendous story. Like, just that's what happened. And that's what he was asked to do. And somehow he pulled it off, you know?
Right.
And there's just one after another. And so that was, when I think about my childhood and what I read and what I kind of struck me and hit me and maybe got my wheels turning, it was those stories.
Wow. Yeah. Now, I know you probably hate to be asked this, since this book comes out tomorrow.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
Well, I do have, I think, like I did with, like I did with Salvage This World, I kind of have kind of an image, and I've got a couple pages written down. I feel like there's a lot in them, and I feel like I can go down the road with it and see what happens. So that's kind of it.
You're at the beginning of something.
Yeah.
Cool.
Which is, you know, rewarding and terrifying at the same time.
Right. Well, I can't thank you enough for spending an hour today, and it's been great talking with you, Michael.
Yeah, you too, Patrick.
We would love to get you out here to the desert one of these days.
I would love to come to the desert. I was really hoping maybe this would be the time, but maybe it'll be next time.
Yeah, we'd love to have you out here. And thanks so much for signing the books, as always. Thanks, everybody, for watching. And let's do a better job of staying in touch. I'll send you an email, and we'll keep in touch.
Absolutely. Let's do it, man. Thanks a lot for the invitation.
You bet. Congratulations on the new book. Take care, man.
Thanks a lot. Bye, everyone.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.